This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Never in history has anything ever been created more complex than the human brain. Life, movement, intelligence are some of the basic functions that are completed with little or no effort, and often taken for granted. The gray matter that resides at the top of our body is a masterpiece of complexity, perfectly engineered to carry out and carry on human life. While in recent history we have begun to understand more about this supercomputer, there is still so much that is a mystery. The effects of external forces govern our actions and emotions, rewire our electrical system, and cripple the brain, both emotionally and physically. We know so much about what goes on inside our mind, yet there is still more to understand. With each new day, advancements offer hope that we may one day be able to heal the unknown and the unseen injuries of the brain. Not all wounds are visible, which makes fixing them all the more difficult. I'm Kevin Donaldson, here with Mike Felice, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, then we're for you, because that's what we do here, and that's the stories we highlight. So do me a favor, hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, ring the bell to get notified of all new content, and now you can join. Follow us on all social media so you can find out exactly what we're up to. And on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, you threw me for a big loop tonight.
This special episode.
It's very special. There's two people in here who I admire, who I follow, who I listen to as if it was canonized law. And we're here tonight to talk to Stephanie Samuels with special guest, the Irish Angel Amanda Coleman. So Stephanie and I have been talking a long time, and Stephanie is doing groundbreaking work into solving this invisible injuries that we have and nobody can see. Before we get into anything, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor, and that's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police, but we do trust them. So go to toyotahackensack.com. Let them find you a car.
My father still has his Toyota of Hackensack car. He still doesn't know the buttons.
No, he hasn't. He has no idea. The sunroof opens every time he turns the key on. So each week, Amanda, you're a podcast veteran, so you know this. Each week, we take a message from our audience. This week's social media question comes from FanCon54. What's the biggest misconception about post-traumatic stress that you know of? Stephanie, you're our guest tonight. I want to lead this one off to you.
So I think that that people think that people with PTSD are crazy.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Perfect.
I hate that word crazy. I get actually offended by that word crazy.
Yeah.
Although I'm writing a book called Man, You Are Crazy.
And it's on your mug.
I'm writing a book called Man, You Are Crazy. And yeah, it's all about rebranding. So crazy is, you got to take ownership of it. Like it's like if I call Mike crazy, that's a good thing because he knows that I'm a little tilted as well. But nobody else is allowed to call him crazy.
And they use it as a weapon, you know, kind of weaponizes what PTSD is, you know, this, they have PTSD, therefore they're crazy, they're PTSD, then they have to be, you know, and they fill in the blanks of all this negativity rather than really understanding what post-traumatic stress disorder really is.
Well, that's what's going to be the fun about this episode, because you've done a deep dive into a different aspect of it. Mike, when you hear some of the stuff that's going to go on tonight, You just watch to the end, everybody, because you're going to understand. Amanda, what do you think? You deal with police officers day in and day out. You've seen a lot. You've seen a lot of dented people. Yeah. What do you think the misconception that from your time of getting involved with police officers to now, what's the biggest misconception you know of?
The misconception, I think, for me is that everybody thinks that you have to be in the services basically to have PTS, when that is not the case at all. Nobody is exempt from it. You know, it can happen to anybody.
Man, woman, child, I don't think anybody is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the scars that's left behind, you know? So, yeah.
I know you have it. Yeah. You have it because we've heard your story. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's right. It's right in the letters. The D, disorder. It's not a disorder.
No. So we recently learned that we always didn't like the word disorder because it's an ugly word. It's like it gets on your skin and you can't shake it off. But we recently heard they're getting rid of the D because it's the brain's natural response.
Disorder almost means you're deformed.
Yeah, it's ugly.
Yeah, it's an ugly word. And listen, I got post-traumatic stress and I don't think I have a disorder.
Well, you got a little bit. You got a lot of disorders.
I got a lot of disorders, but post-traumatic stress isn't one of them.
For me,
I think there's a lot of people, because it happens in the police world, where somebody is diagnosed with chronic post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress or just plain post-traumatic stress, and you can't trust them anymore. Some of the people who I trust the most have post-traumatic stress. As a matter of fact, I gravitate to trust those people more because they understand the way my thought process works and I understand theirs. So it's almost like a common bond where you become connected through whatever stress that you went through. So don't ever think that if somebody comes up to you and says, I have post-traumatic stress, because I used to be very embarrassed to say it, that you can't trust them. Those are the people you can trust because, you know, their brain is rewired, but they're actually more wholesome when it be, I don't really know how to formulate, but I trust people with post-traumatic stress a lot more.
But you know, I mean, it's just weird because people don't understand and they cast judgment. Like I was told, why don't you just snap out of it?
Yeah.
It's not something you can snap out of.
We actually had a therapist. We went to the same therapist through workers' comp and he said, well, you were a cop. Didn't you expect to get shot at? I'm like, no, not really. The statistics
you're
are so
a terrible
low.
Therapist. Weren't you expected to get punched in the face?
Yeah. But the other question is, what type of profile is a human being that takes a job knowing that they're going to be shot at? Wouldn't that be an exclusion for a fitness for duty?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially the person that's doing your fitness for duty post-shooting is the same one that did it pre-shooting. And I always said for a long time, if you're saying that I can no longer do this job because of mental issues, well, this job obviously made me because you passed me and now you're going to fail me. So, well, FanCon 54, thank you so much for sending that in. Tom Flynn is out on location right now getting more questions as we speak. We've been waiting a long time for this, Stephanie.
And we have.
And, you know, I know you sat in a lot of traffic on the way up here. I had to lure you in.
You did.
She got PTS from the traffic.
Yes, you did. She did. Yes, she did. And the only thing that you were hot. I know you were hot.
You have no idea.
Oh, I can't because I get the same in traffic.
Then some idiot sends her a text to make her even more pissed.
Yeah.
So let me give our let me give our audience a little window into this. So Stephanie got caught in some traffic on the way up here coming from Central Jersey. That's Central.
Now it's Central Jersey.
That's Central Jersey. And Mike's like, send me your number. I'm like, don't do it. Don't do it. This is bad. This is really bad.
Yep.
Because I had spoken to you earlier and you told me what was going on. And sure enough, he sends out a text and I'm reading that. I'm like, we're going to lose our guest tonight.
Well, you know what? He knew that because he had a backup.
Yes, he did.
I was trying to send you home.
You
could have rescheduled.
You could have just kindly said, you know what? We've got Amanda here. And she's a rock star. We'll see you another time.
Stephanie, why don't you turn around and go home? We got Amanda here.
Yeah, exactly.
Stephanie, stay.
You're the bonus.
So I found you through a friend of ours, Mike DePalma, who gave me Dr. Anastasia Pytel, and he said, you got to speak to this woman. You got to speak to her because she's going to tell you things that are going to open your eyes. And we connected. I got you on the phone and you just started, you'd never spoken to me. Yep. You had no idea about my backstory or anything. You just started reeling stuff off.
Yep.
And I said, holy shit, to the point where I called Mike and I said, hey, Mike, did you talk to Stephanie at all? Did you give her any background? He goes, no. You know, he said it in a Hoboken accent, but he said no. And it was like you were telling my life story. Now, why don't you give our audience a little window into you? Where'd you grow up? How'd you grow up?
Did you grow up? I'm a female, so the answer is yes. I did grow up. We have to grow up to take care of men that don't grow up.
I refuse to grow up.
Yeah, no, I get that. You're not the exception to the rule, just so you know.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So kind of bicoastal. Spent the first 12 years of my life in Westchester County and then moved out to California. Was there until I was 25, so another about 12 and a half, 13 years. Did my education out there, then did my went to college, did my first master's out there, came back east, and moved to, was in Manhattan for a few years, and then moved out to New Jersey. So I've been out here since I've been 25. So,
were you a military kid?
Military brat?
No.
Yeah.
No. Nope. Dad was an attorney.
Okay.
So had worked He worked for NBC.
That makes perfect sense.
And then we moved out to California. He got a job. He had traveled a tremendous amount. And my brother, who I adore, but was not always the most emotionally insightful person, gave my dad the song "Cats in the Cradle" and had no idea why my dad was sobbing at this. I was like, "Whoa, this doesn't seem good." So my dad ended up, we ended up moving out to California. He got a job working for Filmways. So that was Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and
that. So did you ever meet Lauren Green?
So I did not meet Lauren Green.
Michael Landon?
No.
Carol O'Connor?
No. Trying to think.
I met Carol O'Connor in California one time. He had a restaurant.
That's cool.
Archie Bunker.
That is very cool.
But that's so that's a whole different world out there. I mean,
it's a very different world.
Yeah, you were coming from the East Coast, even Westchester County.
It is. East Coast, I went to a high school known as Beverly Hills High School. So I ended up
90210.
So no. So just so you know, that high school is 90212, but the zip code that everybody wanted to be in was 90210. So anything north of Santa Monica. So there's all that.
That was the cool kid area. That was a cool kid zip code.
Right.
But you saw some things out there that were just so foreign. Like I've been out to California and I try to explain to people what the different parts of the country are outside of New Jersey, New York. It's just, it's a different mindset out there. I don't understand how, first of all, if you're looking at sunshine all the time, there's something wrong with you. You need seasons. I know California has seasons, but you got to go further north.
Yeah, no.
No, no. Yeah.
And my mom, because she grew up back east, so she would change out her closets. I'm like, Mom, you're mentally ill. Like there's no season. She's like, it's winter. She brings out her fur. I'm like, Mom, it's 68. This is really not true. And then the smell of mothballs. I'm like, why do we have mothballs? Like, why is this here? I'm like, oh, God.
I think they gave him away as a parting gift of the Depression.
That was it. Well, because they ordered so many before the Depression.
Exactly.
And they had warehouses full of them. So they used to just give them out on Halloween. They'd give you a bag of mothballs. Yeah.
With the apple. But when you went to school, was it like I'm sure you didn't go to school just for therapy, or did you? Was that always your path?
No. So interesting. So in high school, it's not even a club. It was a group that did kind of peer counseling for kids. You had to apply for it and everything else. So I ended up doing that, except I really wasn't scholastically brilliant. So tutoring kids was never going to be, you know, my peers was never going to be it. Like trying to figure out how to get through math and science was going to be my greatest issue. I'm sure there's lots of politically incorrect things I can probably say about that, but I will try and stay away from it. So
we're all about politically incorrect.
Okay, yeah, so exactly. I went to UCLA, which stands for University of Caucasians Lost Among Asians. So that would kill it. Told you.
So I love it.
So I used to sit in the back of the classroom knowing I was limited, because everything is on a damn bell-shaped curve. And I used to count the black straight hair. And I'm like, there's no way I'm getting a goddamn C. So I would end up leaving the class. And so if you ever look at my transcripts, all of my science classes were done in the summer because the Asians never went to summer school.
Yeah, they didn't have to.
So anyway, it's just part of the politically incorrect stuff. Well, so
what did you go to UCLA for?
So I went undergraduate psych, which was surprising. So in high school, ended up doing, which will kind of absolutely segue into this. So ended up doing this teen support, and then one of the students' moms was a psychologist, and they talked about doing a hotline for teenagers that would be answered by teenagers.
I saw that in your bio.
So I was in the first focus group.
Wow.
And so how, you know, people have asked me all the time about, you know, the hotlines, about, you know, I legislated for cop to cop here in New Jersey, and kind of where the ideas came from. And this is it. Like, what worked for us as teens, you know, and you realize, and when I came back out here and started riding with the different police departments, because I was trying to get psych services, which hadn't been done for debriefings or whatever. This goes back almost 30 some years ago. And
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's the holiday season. Everybody's looking for the perfect gift. The way that I give gifts is I give the gift of time. It's the one thing they're not making any more of.
Okay, everybody always worries about how much money they're going to spend on gifts and everything. It's got to be something that's meaningful and helpful to that person.
You know the one person that always gets denied a gift? And that's ourselves.
We never look out for ourselves. You know, and the best way to get some help for yourself is to make sure you're taking care of your mental health.
Therapy has been such a huge part of my life for the last 10 years, and I have a feeling it's going to continue to be for the rest of my life.
You know, we both went through traumatic incidents, and therapy has been a big part of our life, and it probably will be for the rest of our lives. You know, sometimes you think you know everything about yourself, but there's professionals out there that know more about your brain than you know yourself.
So if you're thinking of giving therapy a shot, there's no better one out there than BetterHelp.
It's entirely online. It's convenient and flexible to your schedule.
So just go online, fill out a brief questionnaire, and you get matched with a licensed therapist.
And at any time, if you need to see a different therapist, you can go to a different therapist at no extra cost.
In the season of giving, give yourself what you need with BetterHelp. Go to BetterHelp.com/suffering for 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/suffering.
And realize that at some point in time, you know, cops, for the first few hours, like if I was doing a ride along with you, and it's like, hey, you know, how long, it's cuter, I was younger. So the first couple hours, you know, you get in, and they're like, you know, how long are you staying? And I'm like, the entire shift. They're like, the what? And I'm like, yeah, the entire shift. And you can just tell that their ass is puckered. They are just miserable with this. And so for the first two—
Yeah, because let me stop you there. Cops will do stuff in their police car that they're not going to do in front of a woman.
That's the least of the issues, I'm sure. So for the first 2 hours, they were absolutely convinced I was put in there by their chief.
Your plant.
Right, by IA. By hour three, they realized nobody had fucking vetted me. There was no way in the world that anybody had actually spoken to me, because if they did, they would have never put me in a police car with anybody. So it ended up being great, because after like hour four, you know, some of that armor starts to come down. And you get to start hearing about some of the calls and some of the emotionally charged stuff. And when I was out west, I spent a lot of time doing ride-alongs with LAPD and Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And that fascinated, you know,
million-dollar idea right there.
What?
Therapy in the passenger seat of a police car.
Absolutely. So I will tell you that's great. I contracted with a bunch of different departments, and it was not uncommon. The chief was all for it. I'll give him a shout-out. Actually, it was Freehold Borough. And Freehold Borough chief said, not a problem. You can take an hour in each car. It's actually an hour and 15 minutes back then. And I used to go from car to car. And they knew, the other officers absolutely knew who was in the practice, because there's all sorts of stuff with confidentiality if they weren't comfortable. But that chief was so proactive.
That's what you get ahead of the situation.
It was awesome.
You know, you stay on top of it. Could you imagine going to one of those calls and you have a therapist sitting right next to you that you could talk to right after that call?
Yeah.
Well, this is,
I mean, that's amazing.
You
that's
become
a brilliant idea.
All you did was become one of their peers after hour two or three. Mm-hmm. And I see this in coaching my kids. Okay. So I coach 10 and 11 year olds. And my oldest, who's first year I'm not coaching him, is 13. Well, he did certain things. You know, he's always been a taller kid, so he always had to watch what he ate. And, you know, I trained him a certain way. And if I'm trying to get to a 10 and 11 year old, a lot of times, now, mind you, my oldest son knows what he knows because I taught him this, but I'll bring him over and I'll say, tell him about how to eat right before a game. All right. And they'll listen to him. And I'm like, you little son of a bitch, how come you're not listening to me? But I know why. I know because it's a peer. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely somebody that speaks at their level. When you sit in that police car in that passenger seat and you're riding along, you are now becoming one of their peers.
Yes. However, I have never worn that gun badge and patch. I have never had to act when something goes south. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's a very, very important delineation that I want to make that clear. The honor goes to you guys. I will say, no matter where I am in the world talking, I have always had the light lift.
But you know, it's not like a peer. It's more of a nonpartisan liaison. You know what I'm saying? You're not part of the department. You're just there pretty much to be a friend with a listening ear.
But I'm going to tell you this from personal experience. While we stand in front of the bullet so to speak. The therapists who, the true therapists in the police world, do the real heavy lifting, because we have, you have to hear us unload stuff that we can't unload to everybody else.
I will say that I bear witness to your pain. that absolutely, that is my job. But it's because you've done your job. And you need to understand that.
But you were something to deflect what was going on in our minds during a shift. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. I think the most entertaining one was when there was a situation, there was a domestic, and there was a young child involved, probably about seven. And a call comes across the radio, and it says, "Bring Sigmund Freud. We have a situation."
So did you come with the white powder on your nose too?
So it was pretty funny. And because they didn't want to arrest, you know, the dad in front of his daughter. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And just, you know, kind of how to navigate that. And I remember sitting on the curb with her. And I remember saying to her, and you know, we were talking about just, you know, different things. And I said, you know, I told her what I did for a living. And I said, "Did anybody tell you that you can be anything you want to be?" And she just looked at me and she said, "No." And I said, "You can be." I said, "That's the beauty of living here."
Well, the individual sitting right next to you is living proof of that. You can be whatever you want to be. I'm not even going to say your age, because nobody can tell how old Amanda is anyway.
It's that Irish skin.
She chose to become involved in the police world, having zero stake in the game, just because she didn't like the way police officers were being treated. How do you go about doing that?
It's just by having a heart. As much as I have nothing to do, apart from my family, I have nothing to do with the police world.
Now you have everything to do with it.
Now I have everything to do with it, because they've basically adopted me into their fold, right?
Well, you're the symbol.
Yeah.
That's what you are.
But it's like, I think, it's like I said earlier on, I think nobody is exempt from PTS or having depression or anxiety. And when I've had repeated trauma since I was a child till probably 16 years ago, as you know. And so having that understanding, right, it doesn't necessarily mean the level of trauma is trauma, and how we process it is what makes us who we are, right? How we deal with it. And so, I can relate to a lot of that repeated trauma. And I think that's why I get it. And I think that's kind of why people actually talk to me, is because I'm no counselor. Like, I'm not, sorry, Mike. Sorry.
It's your first time on a podcast.
No, Amanda actually, Amanda is going to read bedtime stories. Okay, no. With that voice, I'm nodding off over here.
That's why she couldn't be in a police car.
That's what
she
I'm doing.
She couldn't be in a police car on midnights, because she'd be talking and be like.
but it's
a listen thing. It's like, if you understand, if you have empathy and you have an understanding of someone's pain and hurt, just sit and listen. You can relay in so many ways. Even though our experiences are very different, they're very similar in many ways, you know, because trauma is trauma. And you know, you just have to be willing to listen and adopt that situation.
I mean, right? And what you said is so spot on. I mean, what, you know, when we first did, so is Teen Line Cares that got set up for the teens. And when it was time to write the legislation and do, you know, cop to cop, we did the first training. Mm-hmm. So, and in the first training, we flew in the person that was the director of the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is the oldest hotline. And what most people don't know is that the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Hotline would take on most of the hostage negotiators with LAPD, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Santa Monica, all those areas, because teaching them active listening skills and teaching them, because negotiations are typically done on a phone. So that the negotiators ended up being trained by them. So so the first training was done by the director, who's Dr. Jay Nagdeman, and then their head hostage negotiator, who is Ozzie Crenshaw, out with LAPD. So really being able to do that type of training, you know, and I know that since then it's changed. When I went on to do Copline, which is now international, That training, Dr. Jay Nagdeman, actually went on from Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Hotline. He has been with the Los Angeles Police Department in their behavioral science services for the past, I think, 17 years. So he's our lead trainer. He has been for all of this time. But that was key. And so there are typically two reasons why retired officers cannot end up vetting through to end up on COPLINE's lines, because it's an extremely difficult process. Not everybody gets in. And those reasons are, number one, and first and foremost, is that a retired officer doesn't want to have to relive their worst day.
Mm-hmm. And, I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. And they realize that the training, you know, because, you know, they're good listeners, they're this, they're that. However, they don't expect it to be as emotionally charged as it is. And they kind of realize, you know what, I don't really need to go mm-hmm. through this. You know, I earned my retirement and absolutely love it, support it. So they self-exclude. And that normally is around day two. And the other reason why is because they can't give up their favorite toys. And their favorite toys are giving advice and judging. And if you can't get rid of those two, you're also not answering the damn lines.
But I will say this. I've had the unique opportunity to, through Amanda and through Bill Mazur. Bill Mazur actually put this the best. He said, when you get a taste of being a helping professional, and I'll never forget his words. I actually made a clip out of it. That's how much it impacted me. When you get a taste of being a helping professional, there is no drug in the world that will give you a better high than that. So while you're helping somebody else, what you're doing is you're helping yourself.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's the premise of this podcast.
True.
Right? Yeah. Helping everybody else. And
it is. I found a healing. You know, it's like I'm not, and I said this before in the last podcast, I am not the same person I was when I started this. I'm a completely different person in every aspect of my life, you know, and how I think, how I process things. And it's not just about me. Everybody else has these feelings, right? And it makes you more aware of everything that's going on around you and more, you know, more understanding of people. Like, we're very quick to judge people off the hand on how someone acts, how someone looks.
First impressions.
Yeah,
right. I judge him on how he looks every single day.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't?
Stephanie was saying, you better have the rock in there after I'm sitting through all this traffic. I said, well, my partner's bald. I'm about the same size. I'm about the same height as him. Put us together, and you might have something.
No dice.
We didn't cut the monster.
No, absolutely not.
But why did you gravitate towards police work? You just wanted to have a career through the rest of your life?
Yeah, so it's actually interesting that you asked that question, because that's come up a lot, because I don't have law enforcement in my background, you know, much like you. My dad, like I said, he was an attorney. And he actually was a prosecutor in New York for the Southern District. He had he'd been a prosecutor in D.C. and really couldn't deal with kind of the government and not being necessarily the best and the brightest that are hired to do this kind of work. And my dad was a real bright man and a go-getter. So, but he did raise me to make sure that. That should I ever be arrested and I had a dime, do not waste it on ever calling him.
Really?
Oh, he made that damn straight. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
My father said that too.
Yeah.
I'll and you help know you what? Out with anything. He goes, you get arrested, you're on your own.
He's and he was not bullshitting me. And most of the time I poke that bear, I decided not to poke. So,
well, at least you knew you had to be somewhat self-reliant and responsible. That's really what it is. Yes. It's responsibility.
I was just going to say, it teaches responsibility.
We're only talking about that today. It's tough love.
Yeah, it's right? Tough love. Well, I say I bully my kids because I'm trying to make them tough. You know?
Yeah, that's great.
You bully them because they're smaller than you now and you can bully them. And in a couple of years, they're going to be bullying you.
For now, my son is about an inch shorter than me.
Yeah.
That's
stop a good feeding
thing.
Them.
I tried that. You know, I tried to lock them in a closet, but, you know, it's a whole thing.
Wait until about 20 years when they're wiping your ass. Then
just had a vision. That was a vision right there.
It's like a stomach scraper.
Try to get that one out of your head. But police are the most difficult people, hard-headed people to work with. You need to – that's why therapists who work strictly – or not strictly, but mostly with police – they have to be a real special type of person. Mm. You know, and that's why we gravitate towards Dr. Stefanelli, because in my mind, he's one of us.
Yeah.
You know, and but he said it perfectly, is once you gain our trust, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
It's an incredibly loyal population. However, you guys are also an unforgiving population.
Mm-hmm. Oh, without doubt.
Yeah, grudges are held.
Let me tell you, you can do a million things right. You do one thing wrong.
That's it.
It is amazing to watch. So, but I ended up, you know, don't forget it. So I grew up in the 80s out in Los Angeles with the gangs. So, and Los Angeles had, you know, so.
The Watts riots?
So they, no.
The Watts riots were 60s.
I was going to say.
Yeah. That was a little before that.
Jesus.
great job, Mike.
Yeah, threw a
very tactful.
Am I looking better than that, for God's sake?
That's two people I threw off their game tonight.
Holy crap. So LAPD came out with, so CRASH. So CRASH was their gang detail unit. And CRASH used to stand for California Residents Against Street Hoodlums, except that wasn't a warm and fuzzy.
Correct.
Right, yeah. Correct. So we had to redo that. Just like SWAT. SWAT was originally a Special Weapons Attack Team. Yeah. Tag team. Yeah, and then that got changed too. So, and Gates was amazing. Daryl Gates, his men would absolutely go into burning buildings for him. He was truly a cop's cop. So it was during that time, and I still have family back east, and so I was flying cross country and ended up meeting somebody on the plane that I was sitting next to, who I was reading People magazine, because, you know, if you ever really want to know the truth about anything in life, yeah, it's in People magazine.
Sure.
Right? So I was reading the article on gangs, and this young woman says to me, she goes, "Do you know anything about gangs?" I'm thinking to myself, "Huh, I'm a resident expert. I've just read People magazine." I'm like, "Absolutely, I do."
Funny you ask.
Yeah, right. So anyway, make a long story short, her boyfriend was in a gang, and he wanted to get out. Oh, it was like Lily White and truly naive. And I'm like, "Well, we can make that happen."
Yeah.
So I had no idea about like jumping in, about, yeah, you know, OGs,
getting
about
beaten,
any of that crap. So I ended up riding with down in Carson and Compton, which are two of the more difficult, yeah, areas. And I'll never forget, you know, I hadn't been in the back of a car, but I did learn a really cool word. So when I was signing, you know, my waiver, and I was releasing everything, including my stirpees, and I'm like, "What's a stirpee?" And they're like, "Any air, anybody else." I'm like, "Oh, that's cool." So that became like a legal word that I've like maintained my entire life is the word stirpee. And so I had done everything I needed to. I'm now in the car, and as I'm driving off, which nobody loved, again, having a ride along, but I'm in the back seat because they ride two person units. So I'm in the back seat, and the guy goes, "Just so you know, the only thing gangs hate more than each other is police. So if there is a problem and we're caught in crossfire, we're not going to worry about getting you out because we have to take care of the situation." And they're like, "And we need to tell you that the back doors don't open." I'm like, "What the fuck?" I'm like, "Well, what do you mean back doors open?"
Into.
Exactly. So I'm now sitting in the back. I've now signed off on everything. Not that I was worth a dime, but I've learned the word stirpy, which is cool. And I'm like thinking to myself, "Oh my God." And did this like amazing ride along with them. And it was like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
The amount of guts that you had to show and the fortitude, yeah, to step into that willingly, into that dangerous situation. Dangerous situation number one, you sat in the back seat of a police car. Do you understand what goes on in the back seat of a police car?
I do now. Didn't then. I didn't know the word stirpy then.
Every bodily fluid comes out in the back seat.
Yeah, thank
you. Bad.
I got it.
Just getting back to that, did you get any like negative feedback from other cops? It was like, "Oh, we don't want this girl with us."
No, but you can tell that they certainly weren't embracing me, yeah, being there. So, you know, as time went on, it was interesting because I wasn't a one and doneer. And then I went on to, because now I thought I wanted to become a cop. I wanted to go through LAPD. So I ended up riding with the same sergeant over and over and over. And that became a really cool experience because there was a situation that arose. I told the story, you know, in the past. And so we knew that the gang detail unit was always plain clothes, and you know the sergeant wasn't. Except, so there's a situation. He said, you know, that it is not for us to, you know, get out of the vehicles. That, you know, that the gang unit will come. Blah blah blah. Well, there's a situation where we couldn't get the gang unit there, and he gets out of the car, and of course I've already signed my life away, and he is running. So in California they have cinder block walls. So we get to this cinder block wall. You know, I'm running. Like, what the fuck am I going to do? So anyway, I'm running. And he looks at me, and the eyes are the soul. And it was the most bizarre experience, because this is a man that there is nothing between the two of us, absolutely platonic, nothing there. And his eyes are saying it all. And for the first time, I can see fear. And I can see him telling me that he loved me. And I don't mean in that weird way. Yeah. I just mean as a human being that was there. And when he spoke, he said, they know what's over that wall. I don't. And I'm paid to jump it. And that changed my life.
Yeah.
Because I thought to myself at that point, did I want to jump the wall? And could I? Not physically. All of this was emotional. I was getting my first master's at the time in clinical psych. And I thought to myself, holy crap. You know? And you know, I always forget to tell the other side, he did fine, everything turned out, but it was really more about me. It was more about this change that happened to me. And then I ended up getting engaged, moved back east, and ended up working on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in Alphabet City on 6th and D. There were more deaths on 6th and D than there were any place else. And now I was running GED programs or what have you. And it was really interesting because I was working the other side of it. I was now working truly with America's most wanted youth. Everyone had to have they had to be involved in the criminal justice system because that's who we're funded by. So it was really interesting dealing with repeat offenders, most of them drugs, and now being able to truly see that the difference between a cop and a convict was that at some point in time, somebody took a right-hand turn and somebody took a left-hand
turn. Fork in the road. Mm-hmm.
And if not but for the grace of God, so go I.
Yeah.
And so it was really understanding that this was an interesting path. And even when I was out in California and I started looking at gang members, and I thought to myself, it was back then they were starting to give women the weapons because women were in search as much as men were and the power of that. And I thought to myself, my God, to have somebody that would love me enough to kill for me. I know, like bizarre.
It sounds like a romance novel.
But you know, as you're sitting there and you're trying to understand how this stuff happens, and yet it was this brotherhood. It was this family that they had created.
The gang members, yes.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And when I really started to kind of embrace law enforcement and realize I was going to be probably a more advantageous side for me, that I really started looking at your unions and other things as these, you know, healthier gangs, but that you guys will, you know, will, God willing, kill for each other, will take care of each other.
We always say law enforcement is one of the biggest gangs in the world.
So, yes. So it was interesting. So I really didn't veer off. It was just really understanding kind of a person. And interestingly enough, out in California, I had never met a gang member that didn't want to be a cop.
They have a lot in common.
They do.
So we know some reform gangsters.
Gangbangers.
Gangsters. We know some reform gangsters. And once you retire from the battlefield, we actually have a lot in common.
Yeah.
And we get along. You know, just, hey, we're retired. We did what we had to do, and you did what you had to do. Some days you won, some days we won.
Right. Some days you get the bear, some days the bear gets you. Yeah. But here's the profile.
I say it a different way, but I say sometimes you're the toilet paper, but other times you're the shit.
So here's the profile of a cop, but I think it's also going to go for the other. So profile of a cop is somebody who has grown up in crisis, does well in crisis, doesn't know how to live without crisis, issues with a father figure or significant loss early in life, history of abuse. Emotional, physical, sexual, or neglect. Makes for a great cop, makes for a difficult home life.
It's true.
Rang the bell.
She's sorry.
So
she rang the bell.
Check. Check. Check.
So what? So in my practice, you know, and I go over this the first session, and I cannot tell you how many of my officers in the first three sessions disclosed that they had been sexually molested as kids.
It's becoming more and more of a thing now. It's
so, well, this goes back like 35. This goes back 35 years ago when I started the practice. So it's been really interesting. So I've done a lot of work with John Violante, and so I dealt with this with John years and years ago. And I'm like, statistically speaking, I'm telling you that the general population is 1 out of 3 females are molested, 1 out of 7 males. I'm telling you, my practice is 50% of that. And when you and this is part of what needs to be looked at.
It's so scary because you had said that to me on the phone.
Right.
All those things that you just reeled off there. Mm-hmm. And I honestly had the feeling like you punched me in the stomach. It was a
From your eyes it looked like I punched you again just now.
You kind of did.
Exactly.
It was a gut shot of truth.
Yeah.
And it hurt so bad to hear that. But after I heard it, I thought about it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I would talk about it, and I'm like, you're not going to believe this. Like, you're really not going to believe this. And without telling people my own history, because there's parts of my history that are very hidden. Mike knows some, but he doesn't know all. And it's me coming to terms with my path in life. And that's what you're doing. You're opening eyes to, okay, well, it's good that you became a cop because this is why you became a cop, and it's okay. And there's a lot of others out there because when Mike and I were involved in a shooting and we're going through all sorts of different problems, that uncontrollable chaos, we thought we're all alone. We thought there's nobody else like us. And now what you said is, if you go back even further in my past, where I thought I'm shutting this down. I'm never telling anybody this. They're going to think all sorts of bad stuff about me. Well, no, the truth is there's more of me than there aren't.
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely.
And most of those people are probably swallowing their feelings because they don't want to come out. They don't want to come out and say it.
Or a gun.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, and to be able to, you know, I almost don't want to say the word normalize because I don't think it's necessarily normalizing, but to be able to normalize trauma, you know, where this is something that is far more common when we look at the numbers. And when I talk about pedophiles, and for every, because, you know, when I train, this is, you know, this is all stuff that I talk about. So when you deal with a child molester, when you deal with a male that has molested outside of the home, that he has an average of 358 different victims, responsible for over 42,000 counts against those 358 victims. And so when I talk about that, and, you know, for me, I'm not big on numbers without facts. I find that people have sensationalized numbers.
You can manipulate statistics.
Any number you want.
As a traffic investigator, I used to do it all the time.
And you know, and I listen to people, and that kind of pisses me off. So there was two researchers. One was the name of last name of Fuller. The other one was Abel. I think Fuller did the first research on it. And what they got, I want to say, is in Minnesota, is that they were able to convince the attorney general to waive prosecution because they could not get numbers. So they needed to figure out what they were looking at, and in order to do it, they said to the attorney general, "We need for you to waive prosecution. That if people come forward, that for every single victim that they had, that you would waive prosecution." Now, the caveat is, if they didn't account for the person, another person came forward, that was no dice. And that's how we got those numbers. And then Abel repeated it, and it was the same. Years later, I ended up dealing with the head polygrapher. He was retired for the FBI. He was doing a chemical castration study up in Buffalo, and he ended up staying at the house beforehand. And I said, "Listen, you know, like, I think these numbers are a little sensationalized. You know, this is what's going on. What are you seeing?" He said, "Those numbers are accurate until it comes to priests." He said, "Priests are up over 1,000.
You know, so one of the this is harsh. So one of the priests in my I went to Catholic high school. One of the priests in my high school, who I knew very well, he got caught Doing the unthinkable. So my high school friend calls me, and this is the, I'm a cop. I got some wicked humor, like it's bad. And I go, hey, did he ever touch you? And he goes, no. And he goes, did he ever touch you? And I said, no. What, am I not attractive? Well, he never laid a hand on me. But that was my way of bringing light to a really serious situation. And we know this, like we know that this stuff happens because they're protected, and a priest can't do anything wrong. And I'm not shitting on the Catholic Church, because there's some good people there. And I know most of my friends are Catholics. And, but yeah, there's some bad stuff in there.
One of my patients had disclosed to me that he'd been molested. It was a priest. You know, and in my world, you have, you know, X amount, you know, you have like 72 hours or whatever, because there is no statute of limitations for the report if the person still has access to children. So I'll never forget. It was the most unbelievable, fucked up first session that I've ever had. So he discloses it to me. And I said, did you ever, because he'd been a marriage counselor. I'm like, did this ever come up with a marriage counselor? He's like, yes. And I said, did she ever report it? No. Why the hell didn't she report it? Exactly. Like, this is the other problem. The other problem is my lane of therapists that really need to understand what the laws are and to be able to do the right thing. So he had a 2-year-old son at the time. And before the end of the session, I said, have you ever touched your son or ever had any thoughts of touching him? And he looked me in the eye. He said, absolutely not. So he left. We set up a session for the following week. And when he came in, I said to him, I'm going to tell you, I would have lost the form. I never thought you were coming back. He goes, I'll be honest with you, I didn't either. He said, but I'll tell you why I did. He said, because I knew that if you believed that I had ever touched my son, that you would do the right thing and you would report me. And anybody that's willing to do the right thing, I can work with.